I'm Josh Porter, and this is the Van City Church Podcast. The following teaching is part three in our series, Nothing Burdensome. Listing random spiritual disciplines on a calendar probably isn't the best way to cast a vision for your spiritual formation. How do we account for the uniqueness of our own season of life and stage of apprenticeship to Jesus when designing and implementing a rule of life?
More than a decade ago now, my friend and kind of my teaching pastoral mentor, he invited me to give my first sermon in a church. I'm sure it was not very good, but it went okay, all things considered. And then afterward, he told me, you should do this. This should be the thing that you do, more of this kind of thing. And he said, I remember specifically, he said, I sense this call over your life, this call from God over your life. And I thought, neat. Years later, he and the leadership of our church at that time invited me to start Van City Church. It was just me and our overseer, Scott Barguer, back then, and we didn't know what we were doing, but we both agreed it should be done, whatever it was. And then fast forward a couple years into the Van City project, just a year and a half, 2 years in, I was ready to quit. I was the only guy working here full-time, and even a very small church quickly develops like a very long list of time-sensitive demands, and I felt like I was capable of resolving about 25% of them at best. And I was doing so poorly, I didn't think I could keep it up. I was reaching out to other pastors and church, the church that planted us, friends, whoever, and saying, what do you think I should do? What do you think I should do? And I was kind of confused because I felt like God sort of invited me into the whole thing. Lots of people confirmed it. And I didn't feel like God abandoned me or anything. It wasn't like a crisis of faith. I just didn't think I was doing a very good job. And it wasn't like false modesty, like, oh, someone tell me I'm doing really, you know, like, I didn't think it was going very well, and the whole thing was making me pretty unhappy. So I sat down with that same friend who had told me years prior that he sensed this call over my life, and I remember specifically we were drinking coffee together on 13th Avenue in Portland. It was a spring afternoon, which means we were sitting outside because he loves the spring and the sun, and I was squinting and scowling because I hate both. And I remember he asked me what it was that I was actually called to do. So yeah, we said we sense this call over your life. You said you sense this call over your life, but what is it specifically that you have been called to do? Who was it that I was supposed to be? What roles could I and should I actually attempt to fulfill? And then, is it even possible to arrange life in such a way that I could do those things? And if not, something has to change one way or another. Go ahead and turn in your Bibles to the Gospel of Matthew chapter 13. Matthew 13, we're going to do a bit of reading tonight, but you'll be fine. If you're new to Van City, again, welcome. We spend a lot of our teaching time on Sunday evenings working through the scriptures, often one line at a time, doing the hard work of unpacking the text carefully. And then we also devote a lot of time to learning and practicing spiritual disciplines, principles of emotional health and spiritual maturity from the life of Jesus and from hundreds of years of the Jesus movement across the world. And we talk about these things here on Sunday evenings for a bit. And then we meet up throughout the week around dinner tables in groups that we call Van City communities to actually attempt to put what we're learning into practice so that it doesn't just become food for thought or a discussion group, but an actual practicing, functioning church. We're currently in a series and a set of practices all about developing, revising, updating, and living out something called a rule of life. When the early church wrestled with the question of how to best adapt and implement the lifestyle of Jesus into different settings and contexts, that's what they designed, something called a rule of life. It's kind of like a calendar, kind of like a schedule, and it's kind of like a code by which one lives. All of us choose to live by certain rhythms and routines, good or bad, organized or chaotic. If you're in a Van City community and you met earlier this week around the first practice in the series, hopefully you're in the midst of something called a time audit. That's when you make a few notes about the way you already spend your time every single day. Usually that's a pretty revealing practice. A rule of life is a means by which we examine those rhythms and routines, and you start to dispense with the unhealthy, and you organize the things that actually enable you to thrive as a disciple of Jesus. Andy Crouch defines a rule of life as a set of practices to guard our habits and guide our lives. We follow Jesus. We're his apprentices. We set out to be with him. That's the first and foremost role of the apprentice. When Jesus called the 12, he said, so that they might be with him. And then in spending time in the presence of Jesus and under his teaching, learning the things he said, we become more and more like him gradually over time, so that when we become more like Jesus, we become also increasingly capable of actually doing the kinds of things that Jesus did. But how? There's still a big question mark. How do we become like Jesus? And what I mean by that question is, must we all become itinerant rabbis? Should we travel around full time attempting to heal the sick and preach the kingdom of God? Jesus did that. That would be like Jesus. Or forget like the hyper-specific stuff. Do we all have to wake up every single morning very early to pray like Jesus did, all by ourselves, lonely places to pray? Even if your particular season of life involves, say, waking up all night to feed an infant, do you still have to do it exactly the way Jesus did? What if your job would never in a million years give you 40 days off to go fast in the wilderness? Jesus did that. Does that mean you can't be like Jesus? A rule of life is the most practical and effective tool that I've found personally to actually translate the lifestyle of Jesus into your season of life and your stage of apprenticeship. And it's not some new self-help gimmick. It's not a new fad. It was embodied and practiced by Jesus and the early Christians. We talked about that over the last couple of weeks. If you weren't here, go back and listen to the podcast. And we actually have first century writings indicating that the very first generation of Christians were already organizing their spiritual rhythms into shared life schedules. In fact, there's this gem of a line from a first century document called the Didache. It's an early Christian writing that predates some of the writing in the New Testament. Do not let your fasts, meaning they're doing it, do not let your fasts coincide with those of the hypocrites. They fast on Monday and Thursday, so you fast on Wednesday and Friday. How awesome is that? Not only had fasting twice a week become the standard shared life rhythm for the early Christians, they were so punk rock that they refused to fast on the same day as the religious leaders, just on principle. It was a spite fast. I love that. Anyway, my point is that the idea of a rule of life was embodied by Jesus and documented by the early Christians. They just didn't call it a rule of life until around the 6th century, when someone called Saint Benedict organized the idea into a code for monastic life, for monks living in a monastery. But that language has been in use ever since then up until today. Once again, there's no one design for a rule of life, but ordinarily the categories look a little something like this. There's the presence, the mind, the body, relationships and sexuality, work and rest, money, and the gospel. You look into each category, and then you organize the practices that you put in each category by daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and annual rhythms. So me, for example, there are things that I do every single day, like reading the Bible and prayer. There's things that I do every single week, like this church or my Van City community. Some things I do monthly, like a day of silence and solitude, or quarterly, like fasting. But it's not just spiritual disciplines, prayer, fasting, silence and solitude. My rule of life personally also includes things like exercise or family vacations or limits on device use, time to read, time to write. But all those categories and the timing of all the practices you put into each category, what goes where, how much of it, how do you clarify what's most important for your spiritual formation within your season of life, and then translate all of that into a rule of life? The best way to approach the seven categories and their repetitions is to take a self-assessment. In his book, Crafting a Rule of Life, which you actually have for sale at cost at our bookstore in the Annex, if you want to get one after the gathering, Stephen A. Machia argues that a rule of life allows us to clarify our deepest values, our most important relationships, our most authentic hopes and dreams, our most meaningful work, our highest priorities. It allows us to live with intention and purpose in the present moment. To begin, he argues that your personal rule of life will be best realized when it's written from five dimensions of your personhood: your roles, your gifts, desires, your vision, and the mission of your life. So we're going to take a minute to define each of these things from the life of Jesus, which brings us finally to Matthew 13. Again, I'm going to have you guys flip around a bit. So look alive. You guys all right? Yeah. Great. All right. Wow. Hooting and whistling. We're ready to go. Matthew 13, beginning with verse 54. Coming to his hometown, Jesus began teaching the people in the synagogue, and they were amazed. Where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? They asked, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? Aren't his brothers James and Joseph, Simon and Judas? Aren't all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these gifts? And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own town and in his own home. Now, that story is obviously about something very specific, but you can learn a lot of things about Jesus from it. In verse 54, we read that Jesus showed up to town, he went into the synagogue, started teaching. That means that Jesus was, as we know, a teacher or a rabbi. In verse 55, we read that Jesus is the son of the local carpenter. Learning Jesus' dad's profession tells us something fascinating about Jesus himself. In Jesus' context, he would have apprenticed his human dad, Joseph, in the family trade. The word translated as carpenter is actually tekton in Greek, which describes, more generally speaking, like a craftsman or an artisan. We used to think that Jesus was a woodworker, which is where the translation carpenter comes from, but then we learned that there's not much wood to speak of in Nazareth, so scholars now believe that he was probably something more like a stonemason. And for the decades, for the first few decades of Jesus' life, that's what he was doing. He wasn't going around healing the sick or preaching the kingdom that we know of. In a very long season of Jesus' life, he was making things out of rocks with his dad. He was a son, and he was a craftsman. And then that same verse goes on, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? Aren't his brothers with us? Aren't his sisters with us? Which is interesting. It means that Jesus had a mom. We know that. He had brothers and sisters. That means he was a son and a sibling. And before the story ends, Jesus adds, a prophet is not without honor except in his own town. So Jesus understood himself to stand in the tradition of Old Testament figures like Isaiah or Jeremiah from the Hebrew scriptures, who came to provoke and inspire Israel to turn their hearts back to their God, Yahweh. So Jesus was a prophet, but he's actually more than that. Turn a few chapters to the right to chapter 16 in Matthew. Chapter 16. And let's read beginning with verse 13. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do the people say the Son of Man is? That's one of Jesus' favorite terms for himself. Who do people say I am? Now notice, Jesus is traveling around with his apprentices, who he describes not just as students in the story, but they're also his friends, which means Jesus was a friend. And he goes on to say in verse 14, they replied, well, some say you're John the Baptist, others say Elijah, a prophet from the Old Testament, still others Jeremiah, one of the other prophets. And Jesus says, well, what about you? Who do you say I am? And Simon Peter, one of Jesus' close friends and apprentices, he answers and says, you are Israel's Messiah. You are the Son of the living God. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. So Jesus wasn't just a prophet like Isaiah or Jeremiah. Both he and his close friends understood that he was the long-awaited king of Israel, the Christos, the anointed one, the Messiah. And he was also the son of the living God. And from the roles that Jesus fulfilled, meaning he was a friend, he was a son, he was a tekton, he was a prophet, he was the Messiah, he also exercised unique gifts. Now, this sounds really weird to say, to talk about Jesus having unique skill sets, because then it kind of logically implies that he was good at some things in some sense. Remember, he's a human being, but he's not good at other things. But honestly, that makes a ton of sense. Jesus may have been without sin, for sure, but he wasn't some kind of Superman. He didn't try to do every single thing in his life. He had a focus, a unique calling, and he had unique gifts in order to fulfill that calling. So, I don't know, maybe Jesus couldn't paint or sing or something, or maybe you could beat Jesus at foosball. We'll see. You know? Who wants to beat Jesus at foosball? That'd be a terrible. Whoa, you know, man. All right, well, he heard you. So maybe he wasn't awesome at every possible thing because it wasn't his job to do every possible thing. And I can think of a few things more freeing than understanding this and taking it really seriously. But he was particularly gifted in many ways. In the Gospels, we learn that he was good at teaching and leading, that he had incredible interpersonal skills, the way he could read people and speak into their lives, his intellect, his thirst for academia, his craftsmanship and creativity and hospitality, just to name a few of Jesus' unique skill sets. And those roles that he was a son and a sibling and a friend and a prophet, and those skills that he could teach and that he had interpersonal skills and intellect and all that, those things informed the desires of Jesus. Turn a few chapters to the right once again to Matthew 23. Matthew 23, as a Jewish man, a son, a brother, a rabbi, a prophet, he was gifted in teaching, understanding the Torah, his ability to care for other people. There were things that Jesus wanted for his life. Let's read Matthew 23, verse 37. Jesus says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who sent you, how often I have longed to gather your children together, like a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing." Jesus wanted to use his roles and his gifts to teach and show Israel the truth and bring them back to their God, Yahweh. Now, of course, that's not the only thing he wanted. We also read about the way Jesus longs to seek out those that he called the lost, meaning those who don't know the truth or who have wandered from the truth. When Jesus took the first communion with his closest friends, he told them, "I have," and I quote, "eagerly awaited," or eagerly desired, "to eat this Passover with you," meaning he wanted to be with his students. His friends, he wanted to know them and share his life with them. And Jesus' roles and desires informed his vision for life and his mission in the world. He knew who he was. He knew the things he wanted, what he was good at. And that gave him a vision, a purpose, which translated into a mission. Jesus understood himself to be inaugurating what he called God's kingdom. It's the thing he talked about more than any other thing, the kingdom of God. And he explained that his vision and his mission came from the prophet Isaiah. "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." The authors of the New Testament explain his mission in beautifully simple terms. In Acts chapter 10, we read God appointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and power, and he went around doing good and healing all who were under the power of the devil because God was with him. Or how about this one? This is one of my favorite passages in the entire New Testament. "The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work." That is the mission of Jesus. Now, here's where I'm going with all that. The things that Jesus did, his rhythms, his routines, his habits, his disciplines, all these little stories that you read throughout the four biographies of his life, they weren't haphazard, they weren't arbitrary, they were deliberate. Jesus knew what he was doing, and he organized his life in order to do it. He didn't just happen to wake up early and figure, "Well, I'm up, I might as well go be alone by myself and pray." He planned to do that. He disciplined himself to accomplish that routine with consistency because that was important to him, his roles, his skills, his vision, his mission, his desires. He didn't just wander into the wilderness by mistake and figure, "Well, I'm lost, I might as well fast for 40 days to be super spiritual in case the devil shows up." Jesus understood his unique roles. He knew what his skills were. He knew what he wanted. He had a vision and a mission in the world. And out of all of that, he crafted his rule of life. To craft a rule of life for this season and this stage of your apprenticeship, you have to think about who you are, what you're good at, your roles, your responsibilities. You have to think about the things that God asked you to do, or you have to ask God what it is that he wants you to do, and the person that he asked you to be. Now, there are dimensions of the rule of life, and if you're taking notes, it begins with your roles. What are your roles? You can define them by assessing your relationships. That's the easiest way to do it. So think through all your significant relationships and the role that you play in each one. Are you a friend? Or a sister or a brother? Are you a son or a daughter? Are you a husband or a wife? Are you a mom or a dad? Are you a leader? Are you a collaborator? Are you a supporter? Are you an artist or an entrepreneur or a nurse or a contractor or a pilot or engineer or whatever? Now, to be sure, your roles that you fulfill, which is usually defined by your relationships, that's not your identity in the strict sense. Meaning, your identity is exceedingly simple. You are God's beloved daughter. You are God's beloved son. That is your identity. You might also be an artist or an engineer or whatever, but if that was taken from you, and it could be, you'd still be who you are, beloved of God. That's it. Your identity isn't in your interests or your desires. It's not in your sexuality or your vocation or your dreams. Who are you? You are God's beloved daughter. You are God's beloved son. Now, that doesn't mean that your roles don't matter. They do. They're tethered to the people in your life and the things that God has asked you to do. Some experts argue that it's impossible to maintain more than 5 to 7 major roles and remain a healthy, balanced human being. They're probably right. So part of your rule of life, prep work, will be to take a good look at each of the roles that you play and think about which ones drain you and which ones are life-giving, which ones are necessary no matter what, and which ones are kind of optional. You could or couldn't do them, it's up to you. Which roles are healthy and which ones are decidedly less so. And then based on your season of life, and your stage of apprenticeship, meaning are you brand new to Jesus? Have you been following him for years or decades? Which roles require the most attention? Which should be uniquely prioritized? And then you move on to your gifts. To craft a rule of life, you need to understand your gifts, meaning your natural talents, your unique wiring and personality. In what ways has God gifted you to do good in the world for the sake of the kingdom of God? Are you naturally hospitable? Thank God for you people. Are you patient or empathetic? What are your talents? Can you sing or paint or build or solve problems or make things? How would the people closest to you answer those questions if you asked them? Ask them. How does your particular temperament factor into all those things? Are you intellectual and reserved, or are you social and outgoing, or combination of the two? Are you optimistic and idealistic? How do you walk through pain and suffering? Are you avoidant, or do you kind of mire yourself in those things, or something in between? You have to think through your gifts, your talents, your temperament, and then ask yourself, what are my deepest longings? Or another way of phrasing that would be like, what are your core values? This is what we were talking about earlier in the life of Jesus. What are your desires? What desire has God nestled deep in your soul, the pursuit of which brings you to life or gives you tremendous joy? Do you want to see justice done in the world in some specific way? Do you want to care for foster kids or the poor? Do you want to combat racism and oppression? Do you want to change something wrong in the world or add something to the world that seems missing? Do you want to make art or raise children to love Jesus or learn something so that you can teach something? You have to ask yourself, based on those deep desires, how much of your life right now, the time you spend, how much of it actually flows from and back into the deepest desires of your heart? And if you look at those desires on paper, are they consistent with the way that God made you? Are they consistent with what God has asked you to do with your life? And remember, that doesn't necessarily mean that if your desire isn't to be like a foreign missionary or work for a justice nonprofit, then that can't possibly be from God. God may have placed a desire in your heart to cook or to raise kids or to write music or to teach or to work in an office, things that in their own way contribute goodness to the world rather than evil. So what are the desires of your heart? And if you can articulate those desires, you can set them within a long-term vision for your life. And this is kind of big and broad, a life's work that will likely feed into most things you do rather than just one thing you do. Now, years ago, I was beginning like the first version of my rule of life, and I remember writing in my journal, what will be said of me, if anything, by my loved ones when I'm dead? Because, of course, I have to frame it around death. And really, it's a legitimate spiritual practice that's been practiced for hundreds of years. If the people who loved and knew you most stood up to speak with complete honesty at your funeral, what do you hope they will be able to say? Maybe your vision is to act as a spiritual mother. That can be applied in lots of different contexts. Or maybe your vision is to create things that draw other people's attention to God. Again, that can be practiced in lots of different contexts. Or maybe your vision is to do and inspire justice in a time and place. So then you ask yourself, what am I currently doing to pursue that vision. That is your mission. What are the specific purposes unique to this season of your life, this stage of your discipleship, that God is inviting you to fulfill in order to live out your roles and practice your gifts and realize your desires and bring your vision to completion? What roles and relationships need more attention in order to fulfill these things responsibly? And which roles and relationships need to, quite frankly, decrease or maybe even be eliminated? What responsibilities need focus? And on which responsibilities should you pump the brakes? These are the dimensions that inform your rule of life. You don't kind of look at a blank sheet of paper and suddenly go, I guess I'll pray more, maybe fast one day. They all flow from your unique needs in this season of your life, this stage of your apprenticeship, based on the person God has made you to be and asked you to be. And thinking through each thing, your roles, your gifts, your desires, your vision, and your mission, that will go a long way in clarifying your rule of life in this season. That doesn't mean it won't change. Believe me, it will. It will change often. But you still need to know those things in order to clarify it along the way. Your rule of life is written in pencil. We say it all the time, not ink. It will inevitably grow and evolve and adapt with your life and with the evolving needs and focus of your apprenticeship. It doesn't mean that it isn't organized, and it doesn't mean that you don't commit to it. It's going to change, whatever. It is organized, and you do commit to it. It just means that the disciplines and rhythms crucial for one season and stage will probably shift somewhat as you mature or as your life circumstances change. But there is, and this is true of you guys, listen, there is one person that you are, and there are many people that you are not. You can't be everyone, and you should not try. You can live into your own roles, your own gifts, your own desires, your vision, your mission, and you can ask God to clarify those things for you. If you ask God to give you someone else's vision and mission, he'll probably tell you, no, I have this one for you. Your rule of life should reflect those things, the person that God has asked you to be, the roles he's asked you to fulfill, all of that. There are many good and admirable visions and missions that just aren't yours to take up. And there are many wasteful and negligent things to which you dedicate your time and focus, probably already, myself included, that they're not your vision, they're not your mission, and they do not honor your roles and your gifts and the person God has asked you to be. So a rule of life is the outgrowth of the simple realization and acknowledgement of who you are, what is yours to steward in this season of your life, and this stage of your apprenticeship to Jesus. Now, I understand that in a room like ours, in a church like ours, there's lots and lots of parents in the room, and I just get this sense, you know, as I talk about something like that, that this deserves clarifying. This is something that I've realized a lot because, you know, I tend to be, I romanticize a vision. I got stuff I want to do, a person God has, and always some project going on. And I feel like the thing that God has reminded me again and again, like, yeah, that's great. That's part of your vision. That's part of your mission, but primarily your dad. That is your most necessary, urgent need is to raise these kids to follow Jesus well. And that doesn't mean they're like, oh man, no, I'm not an artist or something like that. It just means that I'm learning to fulfill my vision in that unique role with that unique set of attention. And it's going to change as they grow and get older by the grace of God. So it is a rule of life, that is, in the broad sense, a way of life. But the specifics, the details, they are going to vary from season to season. I think it would be good and admirable, you know, to dedicate one's life to building orphanages in India, but that's not what God has asked me to do, at least not yet. And I don't think that I would be any good at that. I don't know the first thing about building anything. I have to call someone like Kyle Oxford or Scott Barguerre just to get tools and then say, great, now that I have them, what am I supposed to do with them, you know? And then those things are not conducive to my roles and my vision, my mission. If I suddenly got on a plane, I'm going to India to build an orphanage, he'd probably be like, what are you doing? I asked you to do these other things. Now, on the other side of that, I would very much like to spend exorbitant amounts of time reading novels and watching Godzilla movies with my kids. You know, we made a pact, my son and I, to watch all 38 Godzilla films before this new one comes out. No, come on, don't, oh, geez, me. We're doing it, man. We're on number 21 already, and we got like 25 days to go before the new one comes out, so we'll be just fine. Now, left to my own devices, I would just do this hours every day. Doesn't mean I wouldn't get anything else done, but, you know, Abby's like, you don't have to watch three every night, she told me. She's, you got plenty of time. We're like, all right, but marathon, Godzilla-thon, so much fun. They're not bad things, none of those things, like reading novels, hanging out with my kids, watching movies. They're good things, but there are other pressing things for me that God has asked me to do. And so I have to learn to organize and prioritize my time and order things in such a way that I don't neglect who I am and what Jesus wants me to do and who I am to become by the empowerment of his Spirit, with a little time left over for Godzilla movies. Now, maybe you're not sure how to answer those questions, and that's fine. The question of who it is you are exactly, or what Jesus wants you to do, or who he's asked you to become, that's fine. Lots of us are in that place. And honestly, sometimes we feel like we have those answers, and then life changes and evolves, and we feel like we don't know exactly anymore, and we wonder if they've changed. So my encouragement is this: ask the Spirit of God to answer those questions for you, or to at least clarify those things if you feel like you've got your hand on some of it, but some of it's still a little hazy. And then sit down with people who know you really well, with people who have more experience and life wisdom, and ask what they see in you. Ask them about your strengths and ask them about your weaknesses. If they love you and they follow Jesus, they're going to be very gracious and kind with you. But it's something, honestly, we all need to learn about ourselves, and something that's hard for us to see. I remember a few years ago, Patrick, who works here at Van City, he was between gigs before he came to work for us, and he reached out to several people, and he just asked them point blank, listen, I'm trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do next in this season, so to do that, I want you to tell me, what do you think you see in me, in my calling? Like, what do you think I'm good at? What do you think I'm not good at? What kinds, do you mind praying for me for a second and listening? That is a very healthy practice to take up again and again and again. I suspect that many of us feel as if our lives could use some kind of organizing, a bit more discipline, or, you know, focus or productivity, however you put it. Certainly a great many of us would very much like to experience what Jesus called life to the fullest. Maybe we don't want to organize anything, we just want to experience life to the fullest. But I also think that some of us believe, maybe deep down, that if we were more organized, and if we were more disciplined or more productive, maybe we'd be doing some kind of incredible thing that would satisfy every dream we ever had and impress everyone. We would be building orphanages in India or putting out fires in Australia, or maybe we'd be starting some nonprofit or making some incredible work of art. Or maybe we think that if we were more organized and disciplined, we'd be having our neighbors over every night, we'd be sharing the gospel constantly, we'd be praying for hours every single morning. I don't know, maybe you would. But thinking like that only widens the gap between where you are and where Jesus is inviting you to be eventually. So what if, hear me out, what if a really good rule of life will, more than anything right now anyway, just make you a less anxious person? Or what if a rule of life in this season mostly just makes you a patient mom? Or what if a good rule of life will enable you to just get a bit better at hearing God's voice at all? Or processing some painful things going on at the moment? Or forgive someone? Or sleep better? What if a good rule of life won't send you overseas or turn you into a monk or bring your entire block to faith in Jesus, but it just gives you more time to rest and to be okay with it? Or helps you feel like you can put down your phone and be fine with it? Or it helps you prioritize time with the people you love and be less scattered. So many of us, I've learned over time, depending on your personality, have a tremendous amount of relationships. We're getting together with dozens of people, but the relationships are extremely shallow because you can't know and be known by lots and lots and lots of people. But what if we had a few relationships in which we invested deeply? Or what if a rule of life just helped us organize our time so that we could get some exercise or go to the dentist? If you approach this whole thing imagining the intended result is to transform you by way of a spreadsheet into an idealized spiritual super you, then one of two things is going to happen right away. You'll bum yourself out when you realize it doesn't work that way, or, and this is more likely, you'll intimidate yourself out of trying before you even start. Don't do that disservice to yourself. A lot of the rule of life I've found over the years is really just taking a thoughtful look at the good stuff already in your life and then with intentionality, finding ways to prioritize and treat it well. And then sure, you will likely also do a thing or two that you weren't doing before. You know, I didn't routinely fast or practice silence and solitude rhythmically before I wrote my rule of life. So stuff like that might change. But when you rightly order the things that you value, the things that are less value sort of naturally move to the bottom of the list. You realize, well, these things were the things I listed when I described my values, my mission, my vision, and I've got all this other stuff down here. And why shouldn't those things move to the bottom of the list? As you write or rewrite or even just reassess your rule of life, my humble invitation is to imagine all of it through the dimensions of your rule, meaning your roles, your gifts, your desires, your vision, your mission. I don't believe, personally, that Jesus is asking you to slavishly copy and paste his rule with exact specificity, because you can't do that. I think that he's inviting us to ask, how would Jesus' lifestyle look in my time and place, in my season of life, in my stage of apprenticeship, lived out by me? What does the lifestyle of Jesus look like for you in this season of your life, at this stage of your apprenticeship, as a teacher or as an artist or a parent or a student or a friend? What does it mean for you to be like Jesus and to put the things of Jesus into practice? Now, of course, the end goal is to be like Jesus, not because we're trying to ascend to some level of super spirituality, but because that's freedom, that's peace, that's life to the fullest. That is what Jesus called rest for your souls. That's the end goal. Be like Jesus with everything that such a seemingly impossible feat entails. That we'd be more spiritually formed, that we'd be more mature, more in tune with the Spirit of God, more Spirit-led, even in the tiniest events of our most ordinary days. But it also means just being able to calm down or not worry so much or rest or be more present to our communities, our spouses, our friends, our kids. It also means a sense of peaceful confidence about that to which we devote our time and attention. That we're where God wants us to be, doing what he wants us to do, and that we're happier for it. Content. That we lack nothing. Whatever his call in our lives, and wherever it sends us, if it sends us overseas or into some big, incredible, headline-generating dream, great. Or just a quiet life on a quiet street, a life of obedience. Either way, that's what we're asking. How do I organize my life for quiet, peaceful obedience? And then you are more you in the process. If your identity is beloved daughter of God, if your identity, first and foremost and only aspect of your identity, your true identity, is beloved of God, beloved daughter of God, beloved son of God, these are the things that allow you to be who you already are with peace and confidence and live out of who you are rather than who you are not. So let's pray and ask God's Spirit to lead us into faithfulness.
Thanks for listening to Van City. You can connect with us and find more teachings and available resources at www.vancity.church. You can support Van City financially at vancity.church/give.